Hello, my name is Jane O'Rourke and welcome to Mind in Mind. In this series of legacy interviews, I'm having conversations with master clinicians, pioneers in child mental health, who've broken new ground in their clinical work, teaching and research. When children and young people get into emotional difficulty, the adults who care for them need access to the latest information and wisest thinking about child mental health. So whether you're working therapeutically, a social worker, parent or teacher, on Mind in Mind, you'll have free access to interviews, research and in-depth thinking. We're covering a wide range of psychological issues, such as anxiety, trauma and depression, and address how children and their families can cope during these times of extreme challenge. I'm especially delighted to feature this legacy interview with Dr. Jean Magagna. Jean is a child, adolescent and family psychotherapist who, during a career spanning more than 50 years, has contributed substantially to the field of child mental health. Jean led the psychotherapy services at Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children in London for 24 years, where she specialised in eating disorders. Her latest book, Psychotherapeutic Understanding of Children and Young People with Eating Disorders, has just been published. In this interview with me, her psychoanalytically informed perspectives on the factors that contribute to eating disorders and how they're best treated, I'm sure will offer you fresh insights. She also insists that with the right care, no young person should ever die of an eating disorder. In this interview, Jean will also explain why the art of observing babies, a technique based on the model taught by the Tavistock Clinic, can transform our understanding of children and their families. Jean has taught generations of child psychotherapists the careful art of observation all over the world. She describes what it was like to learn the craft from the originator of infant observation, Esther Bick. Being taught by Mrs. Bick, Jean says, was an inspiring experience, though also challenging. As Mrs. Bick, says Jean, was in touch with the powerful anxieties of infancy as she faced the end of her life. Jean also describes how it's possible for parents to learn infant observation to deepen their understanding of their children. This led her to inspiring a very special nursery in Rome, and she wrote a book with them, Being Present for Your Nursery Age Child. Somehow, during a very busy clinical career, Jean has found time to write over 90 articles and books. She says her most important book is The Silent Child, Communication Without Words, in which she describes her work with children who aren't speaking, walking, or eating. Of course, by their very nature, silent children are difficult to treat in talking therapies. But I think Jean's skill in observation has made her a particularly insightful clinician. And in doing so, she's helped children to have their voices heard and save their lives. Jean told me her capacity for careful observation was honed at a very early age, which is why it felt appropriate to begin this interview by asking her about her childhood and its influence on her work. So thank you very much for agreeing to talk with me, Jean.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm interested in your background and how you grew up in a small town in Wyoming. It was a coal mining town, I believe. And it's an interesting start for somebody who decided to become a child psychotherapist.
Yes, because there weren't any psychotherapist or psychiatrist or psychologist in my town. And one adult psychiatrist in my state of Wyoming, in the corner, in a mental hospital.
Wow. Okay. So what? Can you think why that background might have led you to becoming a child psychotherapist?
Well, I suspect not understanding was a start, and wanting to understand. So my background was being of an immigrant Italian family who immigrated in 1898 to, of all places, Rock Springs, Wyoming, via New York City and Ellis Island. And they were 18, and they didn't speak a word of English. The four grandparents spoke broken Italian even, because they were educated to the age of 13. So they came to this little town and spoke Italian to my parents. And I heard Italian without them ever speaking a word of Italian to me, so I didn't understand. And I was curious about what I didn't understand, and I think curiosity and wanting to know led me to want to explore in different ways, like travel the world, but also travel in the inner world.
So you became an observer of them?
I became an observer because I couldn't understand the words. Now, some children pick up the language without being spoken to, but I was so absorbed in watching their faces. So they would laugh, and I would understand that it was a good moment, so I would laugh with them. They'd be serious, talking about the political situation in Italy, and I would hear these names about the political leaders, and I'd know it was something about Italy, but I knew nothing about what was actually being discussed. And I felt very left out, and I think I have a difficulty with languages because it's a language which excluded me, like the parental bedroom excluding the children. It was pervasive, and I would accompany my grandmother speaking Italian to people, and not a word of English would be spoken to me the whole hour. I'd just be watching. But I watched. I was interested. So interest, curiosity of what I don't understand, led me to be curious. And then I went to a basketball tournament because sports was the big thing in my town. You had to be interested in athletics and sports to be okay as a person and not a nerd. And so I went to this basketball tournament in a university town, and my friend's sister was going to classes, and she went to two classes that I visited. And one was Freud, the interpretation of dreams, and one was poetry, another language of the unspoken feelings. So I decided when I went to university, I was going to study Freud, psychology, and poetry, English literature. So that's what I did. So that's how I got into studying the inner world, was through going to this class in which suddenly, the curtain opens, and all those things I didn't understand in my head, Freud was talking about. It was very exciting. And I couldn't wait. I started reading Interpretation of Dreams. But then I also said I like knowing about the external world. So when I left university, where I studied literature and psychology, I decided to tour the world. And on $500, which means you're not going to manage very far. So I managed 2 months touring the world, hitchhiking with a friend. And I then went back to Chicago, where it was near my university town. And I had to get a job. And the first job I tried for, they said you'd like it for a week. It was a secretarial job. And the next week you'd like to be the boss. You won't make a good secretary. The next job I applied for was a nursery teacher. I wasn't at all qualified, and that's where I started observing children. And then I was curious, what does this autistic child who does repetitious things and doesn't speak, how am I going to reach him? So I then enrolled in a master's degree in psychology to try to understand this. And after the nursery experience, oh, the children didn't speak English. They were from all different countries, and I had to sing to them because they had 4 different languages. So I sang, now it's time for lunch, now it's time to go home. Anyway, then I worked in, after 2 years, I went into a psychiatric hospital and taught English literature. And I was teaching, doing drama and teaching Othello, I had a production of Othello, and there was a catatonic girl. And I thought, I don't understand. Again, it's the unspoken. I don't understand her. So I wanted to know more about than the psychology teaches you. So I remember at university and grad school, we had to present some work, an hour lecture, and I lectured on Melanie Klein. Accidentally picked Melanie Klein because she talked about understanding the nonverbal, the play of children. So I gave a talk on the play of children, the personification of the play of children, how children are talking to you through their play. And I was riveted by this. And then I came to England and studied at the Tavistock by accident, because the Tavistock is near where I live, and I walked by there and went in one Saturday morning, and the janitor, no, the man who looks after the building, Lofty, was there, and I said, could you give me something about this program, this child and family training? And he said, well, Mrs. Harris happens to be upstairs even though it's Saturday. Do you want to meet her? I said, sure. And she said, we're full. They had 6 child psychotherapists there. She said, but if we have a vacancy, I'll call you. So she called me the night of the party, the child child psychotherapist said, somebody left, you can be in the group. So this was 1968. There were only 6 people training. And that's, I knew nothing about 5 times a week analysis except for Woody Allen jokes. And enrolled in 5 times a week psychoanalysis, and of course it took over my life, basically. 6 years of training, intense training.
So it's interesting, observing children has been something, and observing others has been a really important part of your life from when you were a child.
Yes.
And it's something that is a very big part of the Tavistock training, observing an infant. I think it was John Bowlby started this infant observation,
yes,
wasn't it, in the 1940s?
Yes.
And it's continued on, and it's become part of the Tavistock teaching. And so this coincided, this is a very important part of the child psychotherapy training, really coincided with something that was very important to you. And you've made this a very big part of your working life as well, haven't you?
So Mrs. Harris taught me infant observation. It was my first day in the TAVI observation course. And she was talking about going to visit a family and getting to see a baby and how the baby's personality developed over time. And that obviously involved looking at the context in which the baby was developing with the mother, the father, the siblings. And she had been trained by Esther Vick, who started infant observation. And we would be encouraged to look at the dialogue between the baby and whomever was part of the baby's experience. So for example...
So you used to go once a week?
Mm-hmm. 1 hour a week. Mm-hmm. Very good boundary, like a therapist has with a patient, over a 2-year period. And the idea was to find and create the role of the observer, which meant being emotionally very receptive and empathic, with a psychoanalytic attitude that you're not into criticism, you're into trying to understand anxieties present in the family constellation. And so you're observing and receiving what's said to you by the family, but not actually intervening in any way, except you intervene by just walking in the door, so you might make some pleasantries, but you're not actually interpreting anything. And this is a good training for therapists who often prematurely verbalize things, and to be there quietly receiving. So the Esther Bick, Martha Harris method of observing meant thinking the baby and mother, or the baby and father, are having a dialogue. Who starts it? How does it start? So the first baby observation, I'm having to think, did the baby cry and evoke the mother? Or did the mother go to the baby just because the baby's there, not crying or hungry or tired or wanting a friend? Just the mother went to the baby just to be there. So who started it? How did the baby respond to the mother? Arms out, arms close together. What's happening to the hands? Or is the baby holding the fingers clenched tightly? Is the baby waving them? Is the baby relaxed, feeling very satisfied in that moment? What's happening to the eyes? When the mother approaches, is the baby, or father, is the baby looking? Or is the baby avoiding the glance? Bowlby and the Robertsons talked about, the baby waiting too long for the parents will get too frustrated the parents will turn bad, and the baby receives the mother or father by turning away, because the parents have turned bad, because the baby's cross, they've been left out too much. So learn the language of the eyes, very crucial, really. And then the body. And I think psychoanalysis is trying to focus much more on this part of the experience of early infancy and how it's still, remnants of it are left inside the body that need quite a lot of thinking about how we work with the body. But you see the body of the baby who's uncoordinated initially, flailing about, and gradually when being held by the mother, one sees the beginning of the personality getting more structured inside, because the baby might be moving about, but not flailing about, because they've got some sense of inner strength and some sense that somebody might respond. So you see the orchestration of the body becomes much more refined and knowable to the parents, because the baby has a style of communicating. And we learn about the cry, because there are about 37, there are probably hundreds of cries, but in baby observation, we're not just saying the baby cried. We're having to learn, like Proust, how to describe in a very descriptive way. So you're describing the piercing cry, or the plaintive cry, or the shouting cry. And we're having to do that in the seminar, identify with the baby, and get the, you might call it the melody of the tone. And all these things of closely observing the body, the eyes, the ears, I haven't done the mouth, really help one understand who this baby is at that moment in time with the mother, the father, and the siblings. So the mouth, I wrote a whole paper about the importance of the mouth. You know, the baby doesn't have many resources to protect themselves as a baby, but the one thing they have, they can close their eyes, but they can close their mouth and say, things aren't good between us. So you know, we learn to see when the nipple comes, or the bottle, is the baby receiving the mother, mouth open, or is the baby shutting the mouth, just like shutting the eyes, because saying something's not right. And so we learn these very primitive ways of communicating that influence all of clinical work and human relationships, because they're still there when you're 90. So that's what Mrs. Bick and Mrs. Harris taught in infant observation. Dialogue, not just an isolated incident where the baby was crying. What happened before, what happened after? So that was so important to me, I think, as a significant experience, because as a child, I think I did probably take care of myself very early in this. Well, you're traumatized if you immigrate from a country. You don't leave the country because you loved it there. You immigrate because something was not happening right. My grandmother was starving to death from not having any food. And I think that somehow being hard and strong meant that they expected me to be hard and strong at a very early age and take care of myself. So I think I was riveted by infant observation because I was repairing something about dialogue.
It's interesting what you say about repair, because it's often said that there's a repair for the baby and perhaps the parent too, by having this observer. Mm-hmm. But also there's a repair for the observer.
Yes. I don't think I could verbalize it, and to myself, until I heard people in my infant observation seminar, when I was teaching it, say, actually, by identifying with the baby and getting close to the baby, and then identifying to the mother and the mother's anxieties, they felt more forgiving to their parents. I felt more forgiving to my parents. But also, one woman said, I felt I was healed by watching the baby have a mother so responsive to her. That by identifying with the baby with a mother so responsive, she felt it also repaired something inside. And I think it restores the good parent inside you when you are really close to the observation like that. And probably also the seminar is a healing experience if it's a containing empathic seminar, because a group is holding some things that you might not be able to bear yourself when you do baby observation, which can be quite disturbing. So it grows your own capacity, I think, the group phenomenon, as well as the identifying with the baby and parents.
And it can be quite difficult in the group, can't it?
I think the horrendous part about it is that infant observation evokes all your infantile feelings. And one of those feelings is sibling rivalry. And it's all right if you're the person presenting, but sometimes you see sibling rivalry, meaning people get at the observation because they're rivalous with a good observation. You see all, and so the group leader has to be helping everybody somehow hold some of these infantile feelings by sharing the space, listening to what the person who's less adequate in speaking has to say, you know, allowing for all different variations of observation. And the very inadequate observation is a perfect place for scapegoating to occur when somebody brings a page and a half of observation and if the group is going to get at them. So the teacher has to really help show how you don't have to do a big tick and say that was bad, but help develop the observation. And I really learned a lot from the teaching at the Tavistock of teaching to wonder about things rather than putting a tick. That's not good enough. So wonder, how was the mother holding the baby so that observation gets developed? What kind of way was the baby holding their body and their eyes in the mother's arms? So the 1.5 page observation, which wasn't so adequate, becomes a very interesting 4 page observation. And everybody's benefited by wondering so you have better descriptive detail.
I'm interested in how this is helpful for people working with children, because this is something that you've encouraged in other professions, not just child psychotherapy. How does observing an infant in minute detail like this and its relationship with its parent, how does that help you clinically?
Well, I think not just for a child psychotherapist, but also for a child psychotherapist, it helps you realize that the beginning of an encounter is very important and you need to understand. For example, when the therapist walks in the waiting room, how has the child or adult looked at the therapist? Are they receiving her or are they turned away? That's the first transference. And the first counter-transference is, how do you feel when you receive somebody longing to see you or somebody thinking you're not my cup of tea today? So it helps you to understand that dialogue that before you even enter the consulting room. In the consulting room, you become aware also of not just beginnings, but endings. We know that separation for the baby led to frustration unless they were quite satisfied an encounter and had mother inside. So one has to be aware that the end, near the end of the session, one has to look and see how is the person experiencing saying goodbye, just like a baby has to experience mother walking out of the room, and look at different stages of response to ending a session. So somebody who's just begun therapy can end the session, think, fine, that's all right, I'll wait, come to next week. Somebody who gets involved with the therapist in the therapy can initially feel it's devastating to be dropped until the next session. And it, as time goes on, the anxieties about depending on the therapist, like the infantile anxieties in the first year of life, arise in the patient, and the patient can look worse because they're now in touch with the anxieties of dependence. One writer, you know, talks about counting on her mother and how she's thrust into anguish once she counts on her mother. And that's what happens in therapy too. You get the infantile anxiety stirred up. And if you haven't done infant observation, I think you may not be in touch with the degree of anguish and anxiety and anger or fear that comes with separation. Not just at the end of the session though, and I think this is the part that we're having to talk about more, but also when the therapist doesn't get it.
There's been a mismatch.
Mismatch, and then you see in the patient's dreams. But if you don't understand that separation has repercussions in a very deep way, you might not understand a dream when somebody feels they're falling off the cliff. But if you're in touch with infantile anxieties, you can, and you've seen in the infant observation, you can say, well, my not getting you yesterday seems to have left you feeling very unheld by me. So you have to look in the dream, not just for the mature part that can manage and take care of that self that's very distressed, but also look at very primitive anguish and anxiety and hatred and rage that can create more anxiety. So that's partly how it helps with clinical work. But the second part, which I think is really fundamental, is there's a lot of stuff written by adult analysts and a lot of stuff I believed that I've had to completely rewrite in my mind for myself about the pathological narcissistic structure mentioned yesterday. If you read Rosenfeld's Impasse Interpretation or John Steiner's Psychic Retreats, you understand that the therapist may offer something and the patient might close their mind to it. Or the therapist finds it difficult to be intimate with the therapist giving a good interpretation. And they talk about it as a destructive, omnipotent part, interfering with the rapport between the patient and the analyst, linked to envy. Well, yes, it can be linked to envy that you don't like the analyst having something that you didn't have yourself. Very possible. But there's something more primitive too, which I think Esther Bick was the one who brought to light, which is that if you've developed in early infancy a carapace to hold yourself together and take care of yourself, if you have a good interpretation, it's like breaking that carapace, and it's very frightening, and that carapace is like a part of the self that will fight to gain control of the self. I don't think it's envy always though, I think it's terror of being in an intimate relationship again and suffering again all the anguish of dependence. And if children have been abused, like the doctor and foster children, that omnipotent can say, it'll be terrible, they'll let you down, they'll hurt you, But it's not nonsense. It is their story inside. And so I think doing infant observation helps you much be much more empathic with the second skin that patients have that make therapy so difficult for the analyst. Really difficult. And the silent child is written for people who can't stand silent children. Adolescence in therapy, you know, because it helps people understand that silence is a protection for different reasons, and that they need to understand the silence, not think they want to barge through it, but understand it first.
And it's another area that you have really spent a lot of your career thinking about, these children who don't speak. Because a lot of child psychotherapists and psychiatrists think that if a child can't verbalise, then therapy can't be done, they can't be helped.
Yeah, absolutely right. So there's a child psychiatry text written by a leading English psychiatrist saying, psychoanalytic psychotherapy is appropriate for children of normal intelligence who have the capacity to symbolise their feelings, and in older children to put them into words. So a lot of clinics won't see those children who aren't interested in therapy or don't give a good response to an interpretation in the assessment. My feeling is those are the people that need it most. And the reason they need it most is because they do actions, and I'm thinking of like the children who come. I worked with adoption and fostering for 10 years, and you know, the children come to therapy, they don't want therapy. I don't want to come, I'm not interested, this is boring. Because they're identified with that capsule part of themselves. And
the capsule part.
The capsule part, the, you know, the self that's held themselves together and said, I can take care of myself in this crisis. And they can't locate the self that the therapist is trying to talk to or talk with. So it is boring because the therapist can't get through to that part of themselves. And the therapist first needs to understand that they're taking care of themselves, and this is their way of taking care of themselves. And how scary therapy might be if people talk about feelings, because that's not what they do. And so I think they need it most, because they act out instead, and they steal, and they hit, and they do those things because they can't actually put into symbolic form what the feeling is.
It might be helpful to hear about perhaps a case that you've been involved in, if we can anonymise it, to think about how you helped a child who was silent, and what did you do to bring about some relief for this child?
Well, I can bring one from the paper I wrote about the imprisoned self, because it's published in Meg Harris-Williams' book on counter-dreamers. This is a story of an adolescent girl of 14 who was severely abused in childhood, in the family, and she was suicidal, and the GP thought she should come to therapy, and it was the last thing she wanted to do because she had been taking care of herself for certainly 6 years. Well, she's 14, but she'd been having to fend for herself. And so she came to therapy, and basically she wasn't interested in talking with me. And one of the things I was able to do was to say, I completely understand why this is the last thing you want to do. Because you've had to be strong and hard and get through hell. And that's where you feel your strength is. Therapy helps you get strength too. It helps you get strength from inside. And we're going to build it inside so you don't feel so threatened if we look at your feelings. So this is over a period of time. And still she didn't let me feel really that she could care less about therapy. But I had a dog in my garden. And I wasn't seeing her in my private practice, I was seeing her in the hospital, but somehow she discovered my garden, and I discovered that every day she was visiting my dog because she brought a dream about visiting this old English sheepdog. And I realized I had to venture and say, just exactly where was this sheepdog in the dream? And she confessed. So she still didn't think of counting on me as a therapist, but symbolized through visiting the dog was that there was a part of her longing to see me for therapy. So through the dreams, which are a safe place like children's drawings, I could get in touch with some non-verbalized parts. Now she wasn't not completely verbally silent. She was silent in terms of talking about her feelings, but through dreams, we could talk about them another place. And another girl who was really completely silent for almost a year that I wrote about in Il Modello, no, it's in Meg Harris Williams, no, Il Modello Tavistock. The girl just drew. And I never talked about her feelings for a long, long time. I talked about that person. And that picture must be very scary to other people. So I did it talking with these children who are very defended. I'm not doing you interpretations. I'm doing the space in the dream or the space in the drawing. Technique that Anna Lawrence talks about a lot, about you have to gradually move to you interpretations with these children.
And it's interesting because, of course, people always associate psychoanalytic psychotherapy with dream work, but normally with adults. It's not so common for child psychotherapists to use dream work quite so much as you do. This is a really important part of your work, isn't it?
Well, this must be child psychotherapists of today, I guess, because child psychotherapists in 1968 were sitting in seminars with Donald Meltzer, who was producing his book called Dream Life and giving us seminars on dream life and interpretation of dreams. And it was the central place for our psychoanalytic understanding of where the structure of the personality was. So it's central for me. And in children too, not just with adult patients, because the inpatient eating disorder patients sort of made me even more aware of this. They said, in the inpatient unit, some people get better from anorexia nervosa because they're placating the nurses and doctors by eating the food so they can get out, and they say the right things in therapy so they can get out. And we know they're not ready. They would say, we had a group. And then I looked at the dreams. And of course, in the dreams, you see whether the person is developing a secure base or whether they're in a persecutory state of terror of something, because everything's still projected in this bad, awful world. And you see the truth of how far they develop psychologically. So if I were 50 years younger, I'd like to do research on how you see inner development through the way the dreams progress and moving from projection into others to owning the feelings in oneself to integrating love and hate. But that's not going to happen today because I'm 76. But I think it's a very important area that people could research.
Could you give me an example of some children's drawings that have told you something about their psychic state?
So one little girl who wasn't speaking at the beginning, who was furious that she was brought to the hospital by her parents for an eating disorder because she thought she was big and fat and she was skinny as a rat, drew a picture. Once she started, when to share a picture is quite a big thing. It's like opening your soul a bit to put the pencil down on the paper. She drew a picture of a prison cell, and there was a girl lying on the bed with her head propped in her hands, with tears rolling down her face, with her back turned to the door of the prison where there were bars. And looking through the bars was the mother. But the girl couldn't show the mother her tears. And the girl later talked about how she couldn't show people her feelings, that something stopped her from showing her feelings. But she did it first in the drawing, and that's the omnipotent destructive part, again, imprisoning the anorectic person who has to take care of herself with her hard, steely self. And if you open your heart to your mother or your therapist, which I think that person behind the door is a therapist too, then too much might come in. And the reality is, that's right. Because when the people who have this capsule self or barricading self, when they have it, they haven't really digested all the feelings inside. So the risk is too much comes out too soon unless the therapist finds a way of pacing it by looking at their capacities to cope, not just their feelings, and tries to help them find the one healthy bit inside themselves that can manage whatever they're going through. I could say one more thing about anorexia in relation to that. This feeling that each of the people with anorexia nervosa come to the clinic with about I'm big, I'm fat, I'm ugly. In my mind, it's not only their actual visual perception of themselves, which psychologists have proven that's how they actually see themselves. I think it really is a picture of their state of mind, of undigested feelings with no psychic structure to put a backbone internally. And they feel bulging with overflowing undigested feelings. Mm. And it happens in the session too. I remember one patient felt his head was getting gigantic just talking about the feelings, not just his body. And as the therapy progresses, the body can be felt and seen in a different shape. Obviously it's changing in shape to be a more nourished body, but it doesn't have the feeling of being a huge body any longer.
So I'm interested because you've written that one thing that a lot of anorexic children share is this difficulty in bearing difficult feelings. And is this something to do with containment and parenting as well, that there's often an omnipotence there, that to keep the parents at bay, to become independent, omnipotent, so that they don't have to rely on their parents. And so then the usual process of containment doesn't take place.
So I think you're absolutely right. And again, this is where infant observation is so helpful, because these young people who come with an eating disorder, in my mind, show the eating disorder at 9, 10, 15, whatever age it is. I'm talking about anorexia nervosa in particular because that's what I know about more, and it's more prevalent in these young children. They show it at those ages, but in my mind, the structure has been formed in the first year or 2 years of life, and that when you ask about the early history of these children, you often hear, they're all different people under eating disorder, it's just a symptom, but you often hear that they were a good baby. And how do you become a good baby? Good baby means to parents not crying. You are a crying baby if you're a normal baby. So if you're a baby who doesn't cry, I've written another paper about that, on crying, not crying, and being alone with grief. If you're not crying out in the very early stages, something has meant that you've turned to blockading yourself, to your emotional pain, because that's the only way you can cope. You can't actually cope by turning to parents. And I think that then they might look all right intellectually, might do well in school, but there's a split-off encapsulated part that rears its head as they go through certain changes, moving to secondary school, puberty, changing schools. During times of transition, in particular, the capsule can be too fragile to hold the self that was in anguish that never really got contained. I don't know if that's true for every single person with anorexia nervosa, but it's certainly true for many of the children I've seen. And when I look at the rapport between them and their parents, when by the time I've seen them, there's so much distress in the family. But you see that if they had cried and projected into the parents, it might have been too much for the parents' personality. So they attuned to their parents' personality and closed up. The other kind of situation that Jonah Williams talks about, the no-entry syndrome, is that some children have closed up because they're being projected into by the mother's depression or the mother's psychiatric disorder. And so the closing up is quite a healthy thing to do. It just prevents you from developing. So I wrote in one paper about the development of female sexuality that's in the Journal of Child Psychotherapy. I wrote the young people's group, you know, all the girls are at all different stages of adolescence in the way they look on the outside, but they all have teddy bears on their bed and they're little girls underneath, and something stopped growing because they didn't have the equipment inside. Something was missing. And so you sort of understand there's a thwarted part of the self, even though they might be getting A stars and have lots of friends on the surface. So I think it's an early encapsulation that Sidney Klein writes about when he talks about the encapsulated self. And you can see it emerging in dream life. That's the beauty of dreams. You can see it, the ice cracking, melting, and see feelings coming alive and animals coming out of cages and passion and sensation and bodily sensation, which they might not be in touch with either, coming out in the dreams.
I mean, this must be one of the most terrifying things for a parent to have to go through. And of course they blame themselves for their children's suffering. But you work with the whole family, don't you? It's not just the child in question.
Yes, and the parents' group is even in some ways more effective than the family therapy sometimes, because just that reason that you mentioned, the child starving to death makes the parents feel they're not good parents. And when they find out that all the parents are suffering this guilt, and they look at the parents and they realize they're not such terrible parents. They can see the other parents aren't such terrible parents. They realize that going the avenue of guilt and I'm to blame isn't going to move them anywhere. And that trying to think about what to do now and how to repair now is a much more helpful road to take. And I think in the family therapy, you're having to be a resilient parent, whereas in the parents group, you have a space to look at your vulnerability and your fury that you're stuck in this situation. You don't want them to be doing that in front of their children. You want them to do it either as a couple, or if they're divorced parents, as parents, rather than doing it in front of the child. So we alternated family therapy with couple work, and we also had a parents group as part of our program at Great Ormond Street Hospital.
And you've on occasion had parents become very intensely involved in the recovery of their very severely ill children, haven't you?
Yes, so in Communication Without, what is it called, the Silent Child book, I write about having the parent in the session. And maybe I would have involved her more in parent work. It was a very ill autistic child. I might have involved her and the father if he could have come in the sessions more, but at the time parent work wasn't the style of the day, and I would call her up once a week and talk for a half hour and say, what did you see in the session, what did we observe in the child, and use her as my colleague, as it were, observing, understanding, looking at the counter transfers. And I don't know which country I've given the girl. Anyway, in The Silent Child, I talk about the mother who fed the child every day, that we used her to look after the child, not the nurses.
In the case of the inpatient girl, was she an eating disorders girl, or was she dying? Or was she ill?
The girl that I just mentioned, the mother.
You know, the one who you gave that psychotherapy to 6 times a week.
She was in the pediatric ward.
And what was she suffering from?
She'd given up life. She was in more pervasive retreat. Yeah, when they get healthier, they can become anorectic.
Right.
Or can be underneath anorectic.
Right.
But she wasn't taking in anything. Mm. But she wouldn't have been a severe anorexia nervosa at that time. Mm. She would have been more pervasive retreat. With people with anorexia nervosa, speaking of eating and the difficulty of eating, one of the most effective ways, I think, of helping them is what we started, but they've devised more at the Royal Free now, which is having a nurse go into the family and help them talk to the child before the family meal, help them think about how they're going to be at the family meal, and help them with after the family meal. I think helping the parents develop the skills is a much more cost-effective method than having inpatient hospitalization, if the parents can bear it. But if there's too much breakdown and hostility, first the child needs to realize their life is their own and it doesn't belong to their parents. An inpatient unit helps them realize it's their life, not their parents' life. Christia writes a lovely article about saying to the anorexic, well, you can keep wrecking your life if you want, but it's your life, you know, it's not your mother and father's. You have to decide which way you go. Because often there's quite an enmeshment, and they think, you know, some people fail school to attack their parents, other people, unconsciously, and other people do starving as their method of going on a strike. And he highlighted that and freed the girl from thinking she was her parents' child.
There's an awful statistic, between 10 and 15% of children will die of anorexia, or the causes of anorexia.
Yes. But,
and there's this whole, you know, it's been called the death wish. Now that's something that really horrifies you, doesn't it? It's really something that's not, doesn't sort of coincide with your own work.
It doesn't coincide with any of the work I've done in all these 36 years. And it shouldn't happen. But we have done some research about why it does happen. And it shouldn't happen if we had preventative health measures, which is peers in school telling the teacher when there's a problem, when they see somebody starving, because nobody's noticed it, because denying problems is a very common aspect around anorexia. It shouldn't happen when somebody goes to the GP and the GP says, you're normal weight. When the parent says, yes, but she's lost 4 kilos this month. Normal weight is not a good clue of anorexia nervosa. If somebody's done rapid weight loss, you've got to be very scared. So we did a research with GPs, and they've been not educated enough about anorexia nervosa. We had a half day of instruction, and so we realized that denial was part of the GP training, basically, and GP practice. It shouldn't happen if private psychotherapists liaise with a medical doctor who knows about eating disorders. And I think that's one of the things that ethically needs to change, because people take people into private psychotherapy and are doing, thinking that the therapy is going to help the child recover their weight. And it may not do it fast enough for the child to stay alive, because starving, in Brian Lass and Rachel Bryan's world book, Anorexia Nervosa, starving doesn't just mean you die from starvation. You die because there's not potassium in your blood and you get a heart attack. And various, you know, you die because of liver damage. There's a whole chapter he wrote about the physical dimensions, and private psychotherapists sometimes don't take the body into account sufficiently to think they can't just be doing private psychotherapy. They need the child to have medical attention. It's a medical problem. So those stories of people who've died, I remember these twins in Canada, they talk about people addicted to death. People make it look like they've chosen to die. But I think there's something underneath that, and I've learned that from looking at drawings of people with anorexia nervosa. I think, well, I'm looking at them in therapy. I think the psyche is terrified of losing their mind. And that if you can find another way of surviving, you might cut, or you might take an overdose, you might do anything to get rid of going crazy. But I think that those solutions of turning to masochistic situations are out of terror, and the need to hold on to the bad object that dictates kill yourself. And patients will say, I've got the voice telling me, kill yourself, starve yourself, you're not allowed to eat. They're clinging on to it because they're terrified of just staying in this fragmented state that Esther Bick talks about, of the fear of falling apart. So I think underneath addiction is often another bit, which is terror. You can't survive unless you take the drink, do the alcohol, do the eating disorder. And probably bulimia, I don't know enough about it, but stuff your mouth with food because you can't bear the anxiety, probably has a dimension similar to that too. So that's why infant observation is fundamental.
Well, it's interesting you mention infant observation again and Esther Bick, because I know that you actually did two infant observations. One wasn't enough. You did a second one.
Yes.
With Esther Bick.
Yes.
It was in the final years of her life, wasn't it?
Yes.
Why did
yes.
you do that? I'm interested to hear about that experience.
Well, I think I explained I didn't have a clue the first round. And I think meaning didn't have a clue really means that I hadn't really digested my own early infantile experiences and made sense of them. So therefore, probably was quite blocked seeing a suffering baby, and couldn't quite get it. So I did a second one of it. And because I was asked to teach infant observation, I think it was my learning experience that Mrs. Harris thought I'd learn by leading the seminar. And Esther Bick was known for being such an acute observer and such an empathic observer, and I think it was linked with her own experience of having lost her family in a concentration camp and being near her anxieties about death. So she was in touch with a very primitive aspect of a baby's personality that I don't think people take seriously enough even now about how dependent the baby is on good care and understanding, not just physical care. I think they're the undervalued citizens of our life at the moment.
This is quite an unusual setup. It wasn't a normal type of infant observation that you did with Esther Bigg.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't normal in the first instance because I approached her and said, I'd very much like to learn from you, but I hear you're a very strict, perfectionist teacher, and I won't be able to manage if you criticize me because I'm too anxious and perfectionist myself. I just won't be able to write it up. And so it was very special because she didn't criticize me. She just helped me develop. But the second part was, it was my own private supervision, but people heard about it. She talked about it and I talked about it because it was a very interesting observation, I guess. And so people wanted to come along. And so there were 6 to 13 people joining the seminar at different years because it lasted for 3 years. And I was the only one presenting. And the sad thing about this is, I mean, I love presenting, of course, every week because I got to follow this baby all the way through. And she helped me so much to observe and become a writer. But the second thing was, the French psychoanalyst came over and observed one of the seminars and thought that the method of infant observation in the UK now was having one observer observe one baby and everybody else listening. So that became a part of the training by these leading French infant observers in France, and that wasn't at all the idea. So there's the Tavistock method of infant observation and the French model, and they're very different. The Tavistock model is, let's look at 5 babies and see the different ways they develop in terms of how their parents are with them and how they are with their parents. And let's just see differences and understand the differences, which is very different from what became the French model.
And what was Esther Bigg like in those seminars?
Well, she was she was still a formidable lady. She, I think I told you a little bit about. So, when we first started the seminar, she welcomed us with apple strudel that she made for us, and was a very generous lady, not only in terms of offering her flat and her food, but offering us her heart. I think it was a kind of symbol of how she, we were really like her children, and she gave everything she could to that seminar. So she was piercingly intense. So I bring this baby called Eric, and I'd say, so the mother walked out of the room and Eric was crying and waving his arms in the air. And she'd say, yes. Now, how was he waving his arms? Show us. Was it like this, fast? Or was it slow? What kind of feeling was in his arms? And his face, was his face all contorted? Or was it more just like somebody saying, come back? And what was he looking, what was the face like? And so she would help one put into verbal language this nonverbal material. It was a bit like confetti initially, trying to gather it together and look at every aspect of the body and put it into a verbal description. But I think if you want a good writing course, infant observation's the course. Because you have to find descriptive adjectives for every aspect of the baby's being.
So this form of infant observation has taken on a very interesting application in Italy, in a nursery, in Rome?
Yes, yes.
And you wrote a book about it?
Yes, I, with the nursery teacher, wrote and edited a book called Being Present for Your Nursery Aged Child.
So tell me more about what happens there.
So Temple Inyari is a government-funded nursery in the center of Roland Trastevere, and people from all incomes and different kinds of divorced couples, single young people, married couples, people with handicapped children, disturbed children, come to this nursery. And the nursery teacher, having trained to be a psychotherapist while she was a nursery teacher, decided she would, with my encouragement, stay running the nursery and apply her understanding as a psychotherapist, particularly of infant observation, to her work with nursery parents and teachers. So this nursery, although it's just a state-funded nursery, has become, in my mind, the model for preventative mental health, which is the parents go into Temple Inyari when they're pregnant and book a place in Temple Inyari, have a consultation, have some meetings. Then when the baby's born, they come with the young baby to a parents group and they talk with the nursery teachers and particularly the head Patricia for screening, and they learn to do infant observation about their interaction with the baby and understand the nonverbal communication of the baby, understand the baby has a mind. And I think they're so excited that this stuff has meaning. A bit like I was excited about, you know, dreams, that there's an inner life and there's a meaning in there. And then we did infant observation and young child observation seminars with them on Saturday mornings, where they'd have their children looked after by the grannies, and they observed another baby, not their own, or another child, and they looked at children's play. And suddenly, play with a two-year-old becomes a much more interesting phenomenon when they understand that the children are communicating through their play. And they liked it so much that 17 years later, after the nursery started, the parents rented a space to have parents' groups because they thought the parents' group was such a foundation that supported their couple raising the children that they wanted to offer it themselves to other parents.
And what has been the effect on the families that you've observed there?
Well, I think one of the main things is, in early infancy, the first 3 years, mainly mothers, but not always mothers, have a burden of looking after their children, which after they've been professionals or students, whatever, because some of them are 18, 20, it's quite a shock to change identities and be mother and not be at work. And I think that lack of the structure of work, which also has its social dimension, can be extremely difficult. And they're thrust into a territory where, for their first child, they don't know how to be a mother. And it gives them a place where some of their feelings and anxieties and strengths can be used in this group with other mothers. They can offer things and receive things. And what's interesting is that couples who often have the strain of child rearing on their relationship, statistically, they have so few divorces compared to the statistics of divorce in Italy. I mean, they had one in, I can't remember. So not that I'm against divorce if it's necessary, but I'm just saying that the community allowed couples to work on difficulties that they wouldn't have had if they were just an isolated couple, just the two of them. And the fathers came in, it wasn't just the mothers, which is another important aspect of parent-infant work, that we sometimes forget about fathers, and they're crucial. And the fathers have written, there's a lot of fathers group in that book, and also the fathers who've written about how difficult it is to change to the role of being a father from just being the man at work and the role transition. So it's interesting from that point of view that it brings in fathers.
Fathers are often neglected in therapeutic treatment of children, aren't they, in family work?
It's changing. But I've been to a parent-infant conference where they were talking about mother-baby interaction and intervening with mother-baby, and I raised my hand and said, but the father could be being helpful to the mother too. Where is he? And I think that GPs and clinicians often take over the role of the father. I've said this in the GP practice near me. I was consulting to them regularly, and I said, these mothers are coming in every 2 weeks with a problem with their baby. They're not talking to their husbands, or they don't have husbands. But it's not the child's cough that's the only anxiety. They need a space where somebody hears their anxieties. And I thought GPs would do well to have parents' groups with a doctor coming in and being present for them, but also so that they could get the fathers in. And our intervention in Italy, just very quickly, in Florence, is to have the pediatrician and the psychotherapist meet together with the parents, rather than saying to the parents, go to a psychotherapist. They do the brief consultation with the mother and father and the doctor present. And they do six-session intervention generally on all sorts of problems like constipation and colic. And it's a very good linking, because some parents get thrust out of the psychotherapist and they don't want to go. But they do like their pediatrician because they have them for 17 years or 18 years in Italy. So that's another intervention. And we've brought infant observation into the pediatric training in some places too.
And you've written too about not just fathers being a neglected area in a child's family life that psychotherapy sometimes ignores, but siblings too.
Oh yes, completely. It's not written about. I mean, there are people are writing about siblings, but it's not a developed area yet. In particular, what we discovered in the eating disorder unit is that we think of unemployment as being a family stress, we think of marital stress. But one of the things that we noticed was that the departure of the older child into their peer group or going to university might be a major loss.
So have you got any examples of children you've worked with who've had or has been the harsh older sibling?
Oh, the harsh, well,
is that what you're going to give
me? Yes, I was going to think of the harsh older sibling, yeah. But, I'll start with harsh older sibling. I can't think of somebody who's talking about I can give you some examples, yes. But let me start with the harsh older sibling. So this 9-year-old girl would bring in her dreams how she was attacking her younger sibling for talking to the mother and not letting her have the whole space with her mother. That would be in her dreams. And as the therapy progressed and she felt she could interject helpful, understanding therapist, but also was doing family work with her parents, I think she had more of good parents inside. That allows you to be generous with your sibling. And her dream was that she allowed her sibling to talk to the mother and she didn't get cross. So you saw it wasn't just an external maneuver. It was actually she had generosity inside to share the space. But there was a lot of guilt, of course, about being such a destructive girl, not just in her dreams, but also in the way she stole the space from the younger sibling by doing all sorts of things to capture all the parents' undivided anxiety as well as interest. In terms of working with siblings being hurt by an older sibling, I wrote a paper called Let the Children Be? For a conference in Poland, where I describe a family where the mother has three boys and the mother goes to the kitchen and does the housework and basically is fed up having to look after these three boys and not having much support. So she leaves them to do she lets the children be. There's a 6-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 18-month-old, I think. Letting the children be meant that the older child bullied the second child, who bullied the very young child. And the young child starts laughing after being pushed over and hurt, and developing quite a manic defense in relation to that experience. And I think that kind of carapace, like, it's all right, I'm fine, you see it developing just in that moment. The man, he, 18 months, goes and hits the middle child as though he has any potency. So you see the toughening up that comes from mistreatment too. And then one discovers that the three children, because this hurting is an interaction and creates some intimacy, even though it's a hurtful intimacy, becomes the way in which they create lively intimacy in the presence of a depressed mother. So I think some of this attack isn't simply aggression. I think it's not having internalized enough ways of relating besides attack, and not working out the subtleties that you get if somebody's played with you and talked to you, and you learn to play by yourself and play with others. They learn punch. And when you think about life today, I sort of wonder there isn't a bit of that going on. Knife crime, you don't learn many variations of solving conflict besides punches and knives.
So how did you help that family?
Didn't help that family. Observe that family. But I would have helped that family by helping the father be part of the scenario and understanding the mother, the pressure on the mother, and helping the mother find ways of the children having supervision if it couldn't be her. So I have recommended some families they need a nanny, or they need a nursery more days, because the mother personality would be, I think the mother's personality would have been too threatened if she had to just take on the burden of being with the boys, and I think she was protecting herself from breaking down completely. I resent the fact that I'm guilty for the fact that I didn't turn this observation into a therapeutic observation, but I didn't. So that was another point that I raised in the conference, which is observing pathological observations, I don't think is a useful thing. I think we have to transform it into a therapeutic observation, or get the family to get some help. But Jonah Williams and Eleanor Woodellis moved to therapeutic observations when something like this was happening. I was green and didn't quite get the courage to do it, but I would now.
So it's just over 50 years you first started training.
Yes.
At the Tavistock.
52 years. Gosh.
What would you say has been the legacy of your work? you can say there is a legacy.
I don't think any of my ideas are original. I think they've all come from Herbert Rosenfeld, Martha Harris, Esther Bick, John Steiner, Ann Alvarez. I think I won't be known for any idea. But I think what I'm known for, and I was very ill this whole year, and I think the response I got, I think what I'm known for is not my ideas. I think what I'm known for is that I help students feel that they have the courage to explore their potential as therapists and explore with their patients, and I support them because I was not a wonderful student. I was a good student intellectually, but I wasn't a good psychotherapy student because I know what it feels like not to get it right away, not to be intuitive right away. I think they feel I support them to bear the frustration of not getting it. And so I think what they will get, what people will remember me for, is that I'm a model of a teacher who supports their strengths and asks them how they can use more of their strength, and helps them have the courage to explore what they don't know and bear the frustration of not knowing. More that presence as a teacher. And probably, if I had to do it over again, I'm a teacher. And that's what probably I go around doing, a lot of teaching, because people like that style of simply talking about complex ideas and being supportive to people not knowing. So you don't have to be a good student in my classes.
Which must be a relief.
Which is a terrible relief. A wonderful relief, not a terrible relief. But also the good students know that they have to share the space. So they learn that too.
And if you could be with your younger self, the younger Jean starting off in her 20s.
You didn't tell me you were going to ask me these questions. Look, she's surprising me. Anyway, here we go.
If you could be with your younger self, what would you say to her? Can you be that benevolent teacher?
What age, I wonder? So see, I sailed through school, not a problem, did very well. Intellectually, I could manage all that. It wasn't that which was the issue. The issue was that my immigrant family, who were starving to death and had no money and no language, had to be strong. So I had to be, and I think that just carried over. I don't know, our family does strong. So I say to my sisters, why do we work so hard? And they said, because in our family, to be work is a definition for good. So if I were to talk to my younger self, I would say, allow yourself not to work. And find your other aspects of yourself. Mm. Yeah. One thing, I'm quite happy with my wandering around and finding my way, actually. I think I've been very lucky. So. I think I'd say to my younger self, it was good that you were curious, because you left that little coal mining town where you were a cowgirl, and you found this lovely place called the Tavistock and this lovely city called London, and got freed of having to be the athlete and the cowgirl and the sheep rancher. And it's a big transition, from being the tennis player and the horse rider and the gun shooter to being a little silly girl.
And you've made a huge contribution to child psychotherapy and to children and to families since that time.
A little, yeah. No, I'm pleased that it has been a very satisfying way to live life.
Well, thank you very much for spending the time with me, Jean. I've really appreciated and enjoyed the experience.
Thank you.